now. Only retreat or surrender. Or death.
Well, that's an easy choice for us, Arcadian. Spartans never retreat. Spartans never surrender.
Goes with the one. Let every Greek assembled know the truth of this.
Let each among them search his own soul.
While you're at it, search your own.
This is the Warrior Mind Podcast, and I'm your host, Greg Swanson. Podcasting from beautiful Bend, Oregon, the Warrior Mind Podcast is a personal empowerment series that gives you the information required to develop a mindset of a warrior, maximize your human potential, and achieve peak performance.
Over 4 years and going strong, with over 300,000 downloads from over 9 countries and 5 continents, I'm Greg Swanson, and this is the Warrior Mind Podcast. To find out more about Warrior Mind Coaching and Training, please visit us at www.warriormindcoach.com. Greetings, everyone. Hope you're doing well. It is Memorial Day weekend here in the States, where we remember our fallen heroes that have served us and those that have helped serve us. It is a time of remembrance and reflection and being grateful for the freedom that we have. On Monday, most CrossFit boxes will do the Wad Murph, which is a 1 mile run, followed by 100 pull ups, 200 push ups, 300 air squats, followed by a mile run. So, looking forward to that. And speaking of, I mean, that's quite an endurance type Wad or workout. And speaking of which, I have a special interview right now with a gentleman, Luke Tyberski, who is an endurance adventure. He's just done some crazy stuff. I mean, you'll hear it in here, but he did a triathlon from Monaco to Morocco. And it's the equivalent of going from San Diego to Denver. So this guy, Luke, is just a very special guy. He suffered from depression, went through a lot of challenges, but I think you're going to really, really enjoy this interview, and there's a lot of great points to it. So please welcome and sit back and relax and listen to Luke Tyberski. So Luke, thank you so much for taking time to join me on the podcast today. I've been looking at your bio and your accomplishments, and all I was going to say is, wow, you have done some quite amazing things in your life. And I'm going to put stuff out here on the where the podcast is hosted for people to find out about it. But let's just start in with your story. I mean, you played, I'm going to call it soccer. I know you call it football. So for those who want to, you know, translate, what we mean is the thing that's on the ground that you kick, not the thing that you throw in the air. Right?
Yeah, that's right, Greg. Thanks for having me on, buddy. I appreciate it a lot.
Yeah, great. So you started out in your athletic endeavors as a footballer, right? And you were quite good at it.
Oh yeah, I was okay. I was okay at soccer, which we call it in Australia as well, which the funny accent that I've got at the moment is from. So I played there. I moved away from my hometown when I was 16. So to fulfill my career and try and become a professional. So my family was about 3.5 hours away from me when I finished high school.
Yep.
And moved to Sydney, played there for a few years, and then there was a restructuring within the top competition in Australia. So I decided it's time for me to move on to try and, you know, continue striving to become a better soccer player. And I actually went over to America. I went to some universities over there and played over there for several years. And started to develop a little bit more.
Wow. And so which universities did you play at, just out of curiosity?
I played in the NAIA. Okay. So I played at Brescia University in Kentucky, and that was a good school. It was nice. The team wasn't quite up to the standard that I'd hoped for, and I actually got recruited to University of Louisville in Division One.
Nice.
I thought it was going to be great too, but unfortunately I was red flagged because I – had been paid in Australia to play, and I didn't really know the ins and outs in the NAIA. I was allowed to play for some reason, so I thought, yeah, that's fine. I ended up going from Louisville. I was there for like 6 weeks and did preseason with the team. The school started, and ended up finding a school in Oklahoma called Southern Nazarene University in the NAIA again. Played there for 2 more seasons, finished my exercise science degree, made the final four, the national championships, and the quarterfinals, and had a really good time.
And so what happened after that? I mean, what was your transition from that to this extreme adventure racer that you are now?
So to fast forward a few years, went to the UK, tried my luck in football there, didn't quite work out, went back to New Orleans, played a season there, came back to the UK, and now the story starts getting a bit juicy. I basically was there struggling to find a place to play. I actually went to Belgium for a year to play for a season there, and then came back to the UK, and I got all these injuries, one after another, soft tissue injuries. I had two surgeries on my foot for different reasons, and I just couldn't put a period of time together where I could convince a coach to sign me. And I was in a pretty dark place, and I began to notice I was suffering from depression. But in hindsight, looking back now, it was there for many years prior.
Sure.
So I was having some pretty dark thoughts, some pretty destructive behaviors were going on as well. And I realized this is not living life. And then one day I tore a calf muscle when I was out training. And it was like a light switch, and just went, I'm done. I'm content with my career, and it's time to move on.
Right. You know, I just have to interrupt for a second. You know, what's interesting is I've been trained in NLP, and part of NLP talks about that our unconscious mind, you know, controls our, it helps stay healthy and helps move us around, but also it uses our body to tell us something. And so, you know, all these injuries, I was going to ask you, you know, what did you think your body was telling you? Well, obviously you got that flash of inspiration of what your body is trying to tell you.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. In hindsight, I can look back now that I was in a dark place, having a really struggling emotionally, and it was just telling me to restructure my life. I don't think it was telling me to retire or give up from soccer, but I was in a bit of a stressful time. I was in a, what's the best way to put it? Not the best relationship for me, a destructive relationship, let's say. And I think all that attributed to the injuries that I was getting. So then imagine here I am. I'm hobbling home from a training session I did by myself. I'm injured. And I just give you a little side story. I hated running. I never ran any more than 6 miles in one go. I thought people that ran half marathons were crazy. People that ran marathons had a death wish. Yep. So here I am. I'm hobbling home to my apartment in London where I live now, and I've lived for 7 years. I'm icing my leg, and for some reason, I have no idea still to this day, I started tapping away on the keys on my laptop while I'm icing my calf, looking at Google, searching aimlessly. And then I remember this race that one of my friends in Australia told me about. He is a marathon runner who I just thought he was a nutcase. And he told me about this race in the desert called the Marathon des Sables, which is the equivalent of 6 marathons in 7 days through the Sahara Desert, carrying all your needs and everything for the entire week on your back.
Sounds like a vacation.
Yeah, exactly. And for some stupid reason, I looked it up. I searched for it. I found it. I said, oh, there's 6 months to go. I wonder if there's a place. And before I knew it, I'd called up on the phone, talked to this lady on the other end, and she said, if you pay your deposit today, we've had a few cancellations, you can book yourself a ticket for the Marathon des Sables. And I went, sure, paid my deposit, hung up the phone, and went, oh, my goodness, what am I doing in 6 months?
Obviously, you lost your mind at that point in time.
Oh, very much so, very much so. But looking back now, it was a subconscious escape from life. Yeah. I had played soccer my entire life. All I ever wanted to do was be professional since I was 4 years old. I looked up to my uncle, who was a soccer player. And at 28, when this happened, when I retired, I don't know. I just like switched off, and it's like I need to find something big to replace the thing that was my life. Not just in it, it was my life in soccer. So I think I just had this random thought, and then I ran with it. And then in 6 months' time, I had to run 6 marathons in 7 days through the Sahara Desert. And then I said, okay, everyone's asking me, what are you going to do when you get back? What are you going to do to this and that, whatever. I was playing soccer and I wasn't making a whole lot of money because I was injured. And I was doing a bit of coaching on the side, personal training coaching and fitness coaching on the side. And it's like, what are you going to do when you get back, when you grow up? And I said, I'm going to be an endurance adventurer. And everyone laughed at me. They thought I was crazy. They didn't really know what that meant. Neither did I. I still really didn't know. But I just thought, I'm going to do these crazy big challenges, these big endurance feats, and I'm going to write books about them, write articles about them. I'm going to be on television. I'm going to do this. And the world's going to be taken alight by Luke Tversky, the adventurer. So that was the big goal, which I'm sure we'll get into talking about along the way. That was my big goal. That was what I was searching for, to become an endurance adventurer. And I had this race in 6 months and then went, right, for the next, after the MDS, the Marathon des Sables, I'm going to do crazy big adventures. And as I started to train for the Marathon des Sables, I ran longer. I was doing 10 miles, 15 miles, 25, and I think I ran 25, 30 miles was one of my longest runs, and I wasn't getting injured. And I thought, wow, this endurance stuff's all right, and I was actually enjoying it. So the final thing that I'll add before I let you jump in and ask some questions, because I can you're going for it, is I thought, if I need to be taken seriously about being an endurance adventurer, I need a big, big goal. Something's never been done before, something to put me on the map. So I quite literally stared at a world map with nothing but adventure on my mind, and this route came to me. The Strait of Gibraltar between Morocco and Spain, the southeast Spanish coastline from the southern tip of Spain all the way up to the Spanish-French border. And then there was this little stretch between the Spanish-French border and Monaco. And I thought, I could swim that strait, I could cycle along the southeast coast of Spain, I could run to Monaco. That's a triathlon. That's the ultimate triathlon. I'm going to do it in 4 years. So that's what I had planned. So for the last 4 years, I've been working towards doing that and achieving all these crazy things that I'm sure we're about to talk about.
Wow. So that the latest one you talked about, going from Morocco to Monaco, is that your conception, or was that an existing event?
That route has never been done before. It was just something that I came up with from quite literally staring at the map.
Wow. Awesome. Fantastic. So for those that are listening there, and I don't know if you're familiar, there used to be an event called the Eco Challenge.
I have heard of it. Yeah.
Right. It was Burnett who does Survivor, and he started out with the Eco Challenge, but it was a team and they did something similar. But the one that you did in the Sahara, that was just an individual, right? You had to be by yourself. You carried your own gear. There wasn't a team with you.
No, if you wanted to eat any food, you had to carry it. You had to carry all your water each day. You were rationed each day. Any kit, medical supplies, you carried it all yourself.
So there was no stations for first aid and stuff. It was you. It was all you took care of yourself through the whole race.
There were aid stations, and that did have doctors and nurses and things like that. But if you want to take anything specialty, then you had to carry everything yourself. Yeah.
Wow. Wow. And that was one of those things that you just kind of accidentally stumbled upon, right?
Quite literally. And I guess partially it was the endurance bug. The other half of it was the thrill of, for the first time in many, many years, I felt like I was living life and truly alive. And I just went, wow, this endurance adventuring stuff that I'm going to get into, I want to take the world by storm. And then the next few years after the Marathon des Sables, which I did in 2012, I've just kept racking up more craziness after craziness.
Awesome. So, you know, part of my podcast is about mental strength, building mental strength. And I talk a lot about athletics. I think athletics and sales are two areas in life that people, their mind can take them out of the game very easily. And so when you talked about that you were battling and perhaps still are battling with depression, how did you make it through this first one, right? This thing in the Sahara. I mean, that from playing soccer field, which is what, 100 meters, something like that, to doing literally multiple marathons back to back, how did you mentally prepare, and how did you mentally, when you got into it, how did you make it through that process?
Well, I always was mentally strong for sport. I always did mental strength training throughout my soccer career. I was quite lucky that when I got to my mid to late teenage years, I was quite at a high level in Australia, and I was exposed to some great coaches and medical staff, and also sports psychologists that I work with. So I always did things like visualization, and I had my little checklist that I would come up with positive visualization, so positive outcomes, but also really negative ones. And I would balance that out. So I would get that feel-good feeling when I'm visualizing positive ones. Mm-hmm. But then when I was visualizing the negative ones, like for an example in the Marathon des Sables, I visualized what would happen if I broke my leg, no one was around, and I still had 10 miles to get to the next checkpoint. Mm-hmm. Sounds a bit morbid and a bit crazy, but I thought, well, if it happens and I visualize it now, I know I think I'll be a little bit less stressed, and I'll sort of go through these scenarios, and I feel like my toolbox is more well equipped. And this is what I've done throughout my entire sporting career, and especially with the Marathon des Sables.
That's a great, great point, because many sports psychology books talk about just mentally rehearsing the positive outcome. What do you want? And there's a book that I'm reading, I think it's Stronger, Faster, Better. I might mess up the name of it. And they talked about mental modeling. And this mental modeling is basically looking at, is helping the person focus when things are going wrong. And the mental modeling is rehearsing some of the obstacles you could find in a specific event, whether it's a sales event, whether it's a sporting event, and then how would you react to it? And they gave some examples of pilots that everything went wrong in the plane, it started to crash, but they were able to maintain it. So it's really interesting, and I want to let the listeners know that part that you did is very critical to success, because then you knew, at least let me interpret it, that you knew that if you did break your leg, you had a plan already in place. You wouldn't sit there and wonder what to do. You already mentally rehearsed what that plan was.
Yeah, exactly. And even a step back from that, as I said, I felt like because I rehearsed all these potential negative scenarios when I was doing my visualization, I felt more well-equipped. Mm-hmm. I felt like I was taking more advice from people, because I talked to other people who did the race and negative things and bad things happened to them. So I felt more prepared. And my confidence, I went into this race with confidence higher than I could have if I just thought about the positive things. So I felt like I was a lot more prepared to go into battle with the
power. Wow. I can't overemphasize how that is so critical just in life in general, right? If you're going to go present, you know, I know that you're having a documentary about you, right? And if you, and we'll get into that, but if you mentally rehearsed only the positive outcomes, if somebody says, no, why should we do it? If you didn't mentally rehearse that, you wouldn't have a good explanation for it. So it's not just in the physical part, right? It's just this, when you're going to present a pitch to something, when you're going to do sales, you know, Luke, I can't, that is just so important what you just said, just what you did there. So did that help you also with battling depression during this time? Or how did you manage those emotions?
I shut them away for a long time. It was only been the last 18 months that I really started to open up and speak about my battle. But at the time, I didn't really deal with it. And I was just, when I was playing soccer, it was hard. I had some really tough times, and I think I was so focused on getting back to playing soccer, and I had this goal that was out there, getting another contract. When I was training, I felt positive and I felt good and I felt strong, so to speak. But when I wasn't in front of people or when I was by myself, that's when it was really dark times. And it got to the point literally with injury after injury after injury. And I just was having, you know, I was having some suicidal thoughts and all the rest of it. And I just thought, hang on, this is not me. This is not the Luke that I know. This is not the Luke that everyone else knows. And this is not the true essence of me, of Luke. So I thought, I need to try and do something about this. And it was just thinking that. And it was a year, 2 years after that initial thought where I actually started to do something about it. And I eventually went to see a therapist, a psychotherapist, who didn't know me And no, I didn't tell anyone else I was seeing them. So it was just the only person in the world who knew about what I was going through was his therapist. And for me, that was the first step. And after a few more years, I eventually started to be a little bit more open about it.
Wow. And so how – it sounds like when you're actively engaged with something that is at a high intensity – you know, doing a couple of marathons and stuff, that kind of goes, that those thoughts aren't there because, one, they probably wouldn't benefit you much in the Sahara if you're thinking about some dark thoughts. But so do you consciously put those thoughts away at that point, or is it just an automatic, I don't want to say survival mechanism, but is automatic that, hey, this is what's at hand. I need to survive the Sahara. I need to run from Monaco to Morocco. You know, is that just automatic for you?
I think it goes hand in hand with endurance sports and also just physical activity, because as soon as I'm out of the gate doing these adventures and doing these challenges, the endorphin rush is massive. The adrenaline rush is massive. I feel like I'm achieving in life. I feel like I'm fulfilling dreams that I've set and goals that I've set myself. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like any sort of depressive thoughts and any episodes that I call them depressive episodes are pushed to the side because of all this other positive stuff that's going on in terms of doing these adventures. But it's when I stop, it's when I have too much time to myself where I don't feel like I'm achieving. So if I have a really busy day, like these days, I do big challenges, but I also do motivational speaking. I train other athletes, and all these other things. I'm writing books and things like this. So if I have three things to do in the day, says, right, I want to get these three things done, and I only get one done. If that happens a lot of the times, because my expectations of myself are so high, that can drive me down. So I'm just starting to do some YouTubing, and I just did a little video that should be out next couple of weeks about managing your own expectations on a daily basis. So I'm trying to practice that as well as preach it.
Right, and that's one of the things that, you know, when I coach clients is it's so funny is that we set our own expectations. So we are in control of our emotions, because if we set our expectations too high and we don't hit it, we only have ourselves to blame. Not in that we didn't hit it, but blaming that we set these expectations so high, and that where, you know, how did we come up with this expectation? Where did the data come from to support this expectation? And it's quite interesting. I'll be anxious to look at your YouTube on that.
Yeah, definitely.
So when you're out there, right, you're into the race 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, what do you focus on?
That's the million dollar question. If I had a dollar every time someone asked me that, I'd be doing quite well. So I have numerous things that I focus on. Initially, the first 2 hours of, I don't know what it is, there could be some metabolic change going in the body. I'm changing over from different fuel storage from glycogen to fat, but it's like a 2 hour mark. The first 2 hours of anything I find really boring, and that's the most difficult part. So once I get through those 2 hours, I get into a bit of a rhythm, and then I start just thinking how I feel. I always look up and enjoy the surroundings and say, oh, this is really good. So in the Sahara Desert, it was something completely different that I've never seen before. I'd never been in a desert. When I was in Nepal running down Mount Everest, it's like, wow, this is amazing. And yeah, it's great to be able to connect with your surroundings. But, you know, after you've been going for days and days on end, it is tough. So one of my little tricks that I use for other athletes that I train and I coach and I give them, it's the $100 million spend. Imagine you won $100 million and I quite literally say, spend it all. And I love doing this just because it's such a big fantasy thing. And I've gone 7 hours without even knowing where the hours went by doing this game.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You won all this money and you've got to spend every cent. So think about what you would do. And the first thing people would buy for the majority of people is like houses and cars and look after their family and this and that, whatever. And I say, okay, that's good. So how much did the house cost? And I say, oh, $10 million. Okay, great. Well, hang on, come back, stop there. What's it look like? Visualize what it looks like. Okay, the front of it looks good. Oh, what sort of cars do you have out the front? You have these two cars. Okay, how much did they cost? Cha-ching, cha-ching, do a few maths, light stuff. And then on the inside, what's it look like? So I go through all of this, through all the things that I buy. And if I buy something for my parents or I donate to charity, I say, what that money do? So I get lost in this little fantasy of spending this money And that's something that I do on a regular basis because it sidetracks me from what I'm actually focusing on. And also it's a bit of fun at the same time. And that's one thing that I do.
Oh, that's wonderful. Cause some, you know, many of the sports psychologists also talk about that athletes are either externally focused or internally focused. They either internally focus on their breathing, the rhythm, how they feel, or they're external as far as, you know, looking at the surroundings and that. And that's great as a little combination. I think that's a wonderful, wonderful idea because I will say that I'm not a big runner either. And after my first 100 yards and I'm doing a mile, I'm lost already. So I'll have to spend maybe not $100 million, maybe $1,000 would help me. But. So then, you said something. You ran down Everest. Well, from base camp, right?
Yeah, I did.
Is that a official race or is that one of your inventions that you decided to push yourself?
So it's actually a race and it goes from Gorakshet, which is just a little bit down from base camp. So base camp, mm-hmm. I think, is 5,300 meters above sea level and Gorakshet is the next stop below. It's 5,200 meters or about 16,000 feet, I think.
Right.
So, yeah, it's a race called the Mount Everest Ultra. It's 42 miles, and I went out to do this race. But beforehand, I thought, well, hang on, I'm in Nepal. I should go on some sort of adventure. So I ended up living with some of the
although the race wasn't adventure enough for you. You had to do another adventure.
Yeah, I thought, why not?
Oh, of course.
I've never been to Nepal. I thought I'd go out there 4.5 weeks prior to the race, and I ended up living with some of the country's elite ultra runners in their huts with their families high up in rural Nepal in the mountains. And it was the most incredible thing I've ever done in my life. These people were the happiest people I've ever met, but they had nothing, no water, no running water, no electricity, nothing. It was just an amazing experience.
And did you ask them what their secret to happiness is on this?
Every day was about survival for them. Every day was about survival. Get up, take care of the house, milk the buffalo that they had in their little hut and get breakfast ready, clean up breakfast, sort a few things out in their little hut, you know, do a bit of plowing in the field on the terraces that were there, or go down. If it was market day, they'd take some milk down and I'd get some money for that down to the villages in the bottom of the hills. But, I did speak to, because the ultra runners that were my friends, who I still keep in contact with now, 3 years later,
right?
They spoke a little bit of English so we could communicate through then. And they were big on community. They were big on family. And they were just happy spending time with one another and happy eating. You know, food was a big part of their culture.
Right.
So, you know, and they had no material things or anything like that. And it was just really big family, community orientated atmosphere around food. And that's really how they were living each day of their lives. And that's why they were so happy.
Oh, fantastic. So let me ask you, during that time when you were living with them, you weren't racing, you may have been practicing a little bit, but you were more just enjoying them. Did you have any bouts of depression at that time?
Oh, there's no way I could. I don't think.
Right. I was going to ask you, because, I mean, that's interesting. I mean, right? I mean, here you are. You're really not competing, but you're living around happy people, and they're expressing their gratitude for what their life is. And I would venture to say that eventually it has to, I don't want to call it wear off, but it has to have an effect on a person. And it seemed like it did on you.
Yeah, very much so. I was learning new things every day, and I was watching, and I had a few articles to write about my adventure for magazines back in the UK and in Australia before I went out. So I was taking notes for those, but I was just watching everyone, and I'd go for runs up in the mountains and this and well and whatever. And I did come across some of these women who were carrying the big dukus around their head with the baskets, and it was just phenomenal to see this. And my jaw kept dropping every day, and I was admiring them, and I was just humbled by their very existence and how they existed. So yeah. I think any negative thoughts were pushed aside just because I felt like, I felt like I was going back in time, and it was like an amazing adventure without, you know, doing any huge physical feats.
Right, right. Oh, fantastic. So this race, you just basically, it's all downhill.
There's a couple of uphills. But yeah, so you started in the morning and you ran down to where, to Lukla, where the airport is there. And I had an interesting time because, without giving you too much information, because there's going to be a book out next year about this Nepal adventure, okay. I got altitude sickness, I got giardia, which is a parasite in my intestine.
And it's from dirty water, isn't it?
Yes, kind of. From untreated water, exactly. And I didn't eat, I think, for about 4 days. I couldn't stomach anything for about 4 days, couldn't drink anything for about 4 days. And I still completed the race, but it was a very long day. I didn't fulfill my goals about the race because I was very fit at the time, but let's just say it was a pretty extreme adventure in itself. So you'll find out a bit more about it next year.
Right. So not to give too much away in the book, though, but during that time, your mindset had to change, right? Your goals. If you have, I mean, is that something that you mentally rehearsed beforehand, getting sick? And if it wasn't, how did you handle that change in your goals, right? It said you may have a goal of X amount of kilometers each day, and now with being sick, it's not. How did you handle that all of that mentally?
Yeah, so I went in there thinking about I could have got sick. You know, I had all these shots before I went out, all these vaccinations, taking pills and this and that, whatever. And yeah, I thought about getting sick and altitude sickness, and then how was I going to get down off the mountain? And it was one of those times where it was nothing like I thought, and it was nothing like I practiced. But because I was like, okay, well, this could happen. This is happening right now. But it was that bad, and I was that unwell and that incoherent. I went from, I've got all this arsenal in my backpack and ready to rock and roll, to it doesn't matter because I need to survive. So I properly went into survival mode because I was by myself for pretty much the entire race, or for my own race, down to the bottom of the mountain. There's lots of villages and lots of little huts along the way, and there were checkpoints along the way. I think there's like 3 or 4 in the 40 miles, so not very close together. But yeah, and there's other people on the trails, but I was passing in and out of consciousness. I was waking, coming to, on the side of the trail on the cliff, and I just was blacking out for periods of time, and that was quite literally in a state of survival. And every now and again, when I come back to consciousness and I realize what I had involved, because I knew the trail, because we trekked up it for about 8 days, and it took me 10.5 hours to get down it, but I kept giving myself some encouragement by things that I've done in the past. So another trick or another exercise that I do is called the power of five. And it's, I break anything with a big number, or I break anything down to five.
Yep.
And the way I do it is, the first one, you've just got to do it. It's the first one. And I used to do this exercise when I was doing sprint training in football. So I'd be like, the first one, you just got to do it. It's going to hurt. It's painful. Just get over with. Now, the second one, I know what it's going to feel like. I know what it's going to be like because I've done the first one already. Now, the third one, this is the worst one. It's horrible. It's the top of the mountain. If you look at your hand, you know, the tip is it's horrible. Just, you're going to have to suck it up. Now, when I get to the fourth one, I go, if I just do this one, I've only got one more. And that is a little carrot that encourages me to get through that fourth one. And then it's like, well, I've only got one more. So in my mind, I would go, okay, I remember the villages, and I say, okay, I've got 7 villages. So I'd sort of go, well, I'd park that idea and go, let me get to this next 2 villages, and then I'll do that. And then when I finished, there's actually 5 little peaks and troughs in the hills. And I went, okay, I've got 5 of these here. And at times, it was quite literally take 5 steps. Or count to 10 5 times when I was running and things like this. So I used that probably a dozen times on my way down in the 10.5 hours as well.
Man. So at some point, though, it's possible, or you could have stopped, right? You could have stopped at one of the villages, asked for help, and just, I presuming, and given up on the race. Or was it just a matter you had to finish it no matter what?
You could have, and you could have stopped at one of the checkpoints. But as you can probably tell, I'm not one to quit or give up.
Right.
And I will push myself to quite literally my limits and beyond, which I did in the ultimate triathlon, which I'm sure we'll get onto in a bit. But yeah, I'm very much like, I was like that with football as well. I was quite extreme and I would go after it no matter what, with all my training and, you know, with all my mental strength exercises, with my gym work and with watching film for games. I was quite obsessed, and I got quite obsessed with all these adventures as well. And I would stop at nothing to achieve these goals unless they were taken from me in a way. And then my other arsenals were things like, I always had clarity in what I wanted to achieve and why I was doing these things, and I knew why. So when it got really tough and if I wanted to give up, it's like, no, I know why I'm doing these because I've got clarity in that. So that would push me forward. And then when these setbacks would come, or when the goalposts shifted that were out of my control, I would adapt. Mm-hmm. The goalposts would change, so my goal would change, and I would adapt to those. And then, go from there.
So it's behavior flexibility that helped. But also what I'm hearing is that each adventure built on the previous one as far as pushing your mental strength and your boundaries. There was a little bit more. So you know that what you did in the Sahara, that you knew what that pain was like and you knew you endured it. So once you reach that pain, it's just five more steps past that pain, effectively, right? Or five more segments or five more something. And then you continually built on it. In Japan, they have a process called Kyazen, and it's a little bit better every day. And it sounds like whatever that little bit is all our own. But it sounds like each one of yours races help build that so that you continually built upon your mental strength, your physical strength, and your emotional strength to make it through.
Yeah, and I jumped into the deep end with these endurance sports doing the marathon to subs. So my normal for physical feats now went quite high. And then I went out to Nepal and I'm running up and down mountains, and I trekked to base camp and I ran down from base camp. And with all the pain, with all the giardia and everything else, the altitude sickness. So my normal and my pain threshold and my understanding of what my body and mind is possible to achieve has just skyrocketed from doing these adventures. So
which brings us to the ultra triathlon, right? It seems like this is the pinnacle, no pun intended, as far as mountain, but it seems like this is going to be pretty tough, but I'm sure you'll figure a way. Talk to me a little bit about, I know that you said you saw this route, it came to you, and you know, these are just wonderful. For those that listen to the podcast, these are these synchronistic events that just we get to see when we're in a state of consciousness, when we're in a state of receptivity, we see these things in front of us. And for you, it was Morocco to Monaco. And it was like a light flashing in front of you. And so tell a little bit about the preparation and, you know, a little bit more about it.
Yeah. So as I said, when I did the marathon to stars, before I went out, I wanted to do something big. I wanted to put myself on the map as an endurance adventurer. And that's what all these challenges were about, giving myself content. So I created the ultimate triathlon. And it's a 1,200 mile in 12 days. So it's 2,000 kilometers in 12 days. And that sounds a little bit better. So that's why I say that.
Well, and for those in the States, that's the equivalent of going from San Diego to Denver, Colorado, in 12 days. Now just think about that. That's a massive, massive distance. So I just need to give it to some perspective for those here in the States.
Yeah, no, that's no problem. So the plan was, I set this goal. I looked at the route and I was going to swim from Morocco to Spain, which people do. People have done in the past. And there's a boat company that ferries you across, like guide you. And it's about, from point to point, it's 10 miles. But realistically, you swim anywhere between 12 and 15 because of the currents of the tides.
And it depends how lost you get.
Yeah, exactly. And then I was going to jump on my bike and cycle the same day I did the swim and cycle a little bit. But then basically, so it's 4 and a bit days of cycling. And I was going to cover, I think it was in miles, I'm not sure. Anyway, the length of Britain. So 800 miles. The length of Britain in just over 4 days. And then I was going to leave my bike at the Spanish-France border, so to speak, and then run the equivalent of 14 marathons in 7 days to Monaco. That's what the ultimate triathlon was.
And you survived.
I'm still here to tell the tale. There was plenty of twists and turns, and it didn't go to plan, But something of
but
this.
But the plan was to survive, and so that the ultimate plan worked.
Exactly. That was my mum's plan for me anyway. Quite literally, I talked about earlier having the clarity in why I do these things and what I want to achieve. And my clarity was that this was my big thing to put me on the map. And I wanted to do 2,000 kilometers in 12 days from Morocco to Monaco. That was it. I had this route planned out and it was all looked lovely. But what happened? So going back to the adaptive behaviors that we spoke about before, it's without giving too much away, because there's a book coming out next year about this, and also the documentary is coming out in September, and I may actually have some screenings in LA. I'm still trying to work a few things out as well. So, you know, you can look out for that later. But what happened was, right, I got down there and I'd been told for 2.5 years of research, talking to the boat company, the Spanish boat company, that I could swim from Morocco to Spain. It was going to be more difficult than the opposite direction from Spain to Morocco, which they normally do. But they said, mm-hmm, you can do it, it's just more difficult. And I said, fine. I worked with a coach who had done Spain, Morocco, Morocco, Spain in one day. He's a fish. So, wow. I looked to you know, people who had done it before, so I got the best advice. Mm-hmm. And I got down there, and I think it was like 4 days before I went to swim, they said it's also going to be twice the distance because of the way the currents are from Morocco to Spain. You have to swim further. You have to start further down the coast out into the ocean and come back into the strait. I wasn't fit enough for this. So quite literally, when we had this swim briefing, I made the decision quite quickly, and I got quite emotional about it afterwards, because I'd been Morocco to Monaco. This was the big goal, but I had to adapt. Otherwise, the dream was finished. So I had clarity in what I wanted to achieve, the 2,000 kilometers in 12 days, but the goalposts were moved out of my hands. I wasn't fit enough to do the Morocco to Spain swim because I wasn't given the full information 2.5 years earlier. So what I actually did was swim from Spain to Morocco, got on a boat, which took an hour to go back to Spain, and then jumped on the bike. Now, the swim, I make it sound like, oh, it was so much easier going the other way. I still swam just over 14 miles, and it took me 5 hours. So it wasn't easy.
Right. It wasn't a walk in the park, as we say here. That was pretty significant regardless. And then if you went the other way, it probably been twice as long as what I'm hearing.
Yeah, exactly. And I got hit with two really strong currents where I really had to sprint for an hour at a time. So I was nonstop. It's the most difficult swimming I've ever done in my life. I inflamed a bursa in my shoulder that I had to have in cortisone injections for when I got back. And it was struggling on the bike as well. So it was a pretty rough swim. But then I had an hour sort of rest and I got back to Spain, Tarifa, and we did 45 minutes turnaround. I got back on the bike, cycled about 70 miles that day. And then I had 4 big days to cycle before I was going to start the run.
So it was the 1 day and then 4 big days. So it was still the 5.
Yeah. But what happened, it must have been after day 3 or during day 3, so I had the second big day of the bike, is I got this strain in my hamstring, and it was from whatever reason. And so that was festering below, and I was getting treatment along the way. But going to how mentally strong, and I think you'll find this really interesting, how mentally strong I always thought I was. And I've always had this understanding, even as a footballer, that I believe, truly believe, that there's no one else more mentally strong than I am. I don't think I'm the most mentally strong person in the world. I just believe that there's no one else more mentally strong than I am. So this is the mentality that I've believed in myself and always trained in thinking this. And I thought, someone have done this, and I'll use that. Well, if they can do this, well, why can't I do that extra step? Now, where I'm going with this is, everyone says in endurance sports, your mind will give up before your body will. When your mind says quit, as in life or in the gym or doing endurance sports, you've still got X percent left. Well, I pushed myself that hard on the second day, did like 240 miles, I think, on the bike, 240 miles on the bike, sorry. And then the next day I did like 220. That end of that third day, without giving too much, I pushed myself that hard, I was unconscious at the end of the day. My crew found me weaving in and out of the road in Spain at 1 o'clock in the morning. I was unconscious. I couldn't talk. I was unresponsive. And they grabbed me off the bike, put me in the back of the van, and I was out. I was out. And the next – and I don't remember cycling with the time lapse from – I filmed myself a couple hours earlier, and the crew did some filming in the car with themselves, and they lost me because I didn't take an exit I was supposed to because I wasn't coherent.
Right.
Basically, we realized I cycled for about 3 hours without – any recollection until they found me. And the next thing I remember from 3 hours prior is waking up in a foreign hotel room without any recollection of getting there. And in hindsight and looking back, I think I'm very rare in this case that I will push my body so hard, my mind is strong enough to push my body so hard that my body will stop, give up, break before my mind is done.
Yeah. Wow. That's amazing. That's amazing. So this was documented on a film, right? And the film's coming out and the book is coming out. So what I heard is you have two books coming out.
Yes. I've got one that's basically my story from Australia growing up to Monaco. So everything to Morocco to Monaco. And then I've got a separate book coming out next year just on the Nepal trip. Because it was such a big trip, there were so many things that went on. We said, let's just take the Nepal trip out of the full-length book that I'm doing about my journey because there's so much stuff going on there. So, yeah, next year is going to be lots of things coming out.
And a film, which is done because you said it's being previewed in L.A. So the film about the ultimate triathlon is done, completed. Are you looking to submit it to any festivals here in the United States, like the Cannes or something like that?
Yeah, definitely looking to submit to some film festivals first and foremost. And then, yeah, if we feel it fits in other festivals around the world, we'll submit that as well. The filmmaker who I work with, Physique Media, a guy who lives in the UK, he's very talented and he deserves to get some recognition from the story that he's going to tell from the footage that he shot. It's amazing. Right.
So how can people find out about – so first of all, Luke, again, thank you so much for taking time. The story is amazing. I probably could sit down over a couple of beers and just record all of that for give good 5-6 hours about all your adventures, and looking forward to the books coming out. But how can people find out, one, about the movie, and then – and then how can they find out more about you to follow your escapades? And I'm sure you have bigger adventures coming up and more fun things in store for it. So tell the listeners a little bit how to track your movie and then how to get in contact with you and follow you.
Yeah, the best way to do it is luketiberski.com. And I'm Luke Tiberski on everything. I do Instagram, I do Facebook, I do Twitter. I've got my YouTube channel, and I'm just quite literally next week starting to bring out weekly videos on across everything that I do. I'm also a real food cook. I only use real food when I do all these big adventures, and I cook pretty handy in the kitchen. But yeah, so follow me on any of those social medias. My email's on my website, and also theultimatetriathlon.co is the official website for the adventure. And if you follow me on any social media, you will definitely know when the film is going to come out. We're hoping to have some screenings around the world. And if you're in the city where there's a few screenings, you'll be lucky enough to come along. If not, it'll be available as a download and you'll be able to watch it in the comfort of your own home.
Fantastic. Are you going to be joining the films as a special guest at some of the film locations?
I hope to, as many as I can. It just depends finances and how much my sponsors want to move me around the world, to be honest.
Understand. And for the listeners, I will be posting all of Luke's information on the page where this is being hosted. So you can come over to the page, just click on it, and it'll take you to all of Luke's locations. Again, Luke, thank you so, so much. Your story is ultimately inspiring. I mean, it is just fantastic. It's a pleasure to meet you and looking forward to watching more adventures from you. And just, I think you gave the listeners some really great tips on mental strength and how to persevere through some obstacles. But again, thank you so, so much.
Thanks, Greg. It's a pleasure being on here with you.
Great. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Warrior Mind podcast. If you like what you heard, please tell your friends and subscribe at warriormindcoach.com/podcast. Also, make sure you sign up for the Warrior Mind newsletter and check out our blog at warriormindcoach.com/blog. Until next time, live with courage And remember, every facet, every compartment of your mind is to be programmed by you. And unless you take your rightful responsibility and begin to program your own mind, the world will program it for you.
I am not a warrior. Very soon.